continuing our reflection on the teachings of the Buddha. Continuing our contemplation of the Dhamma, the way things are. It is always apparent to us, here and now, Sanditiko, this Dhamma, this way things are, is continually manifesting itself to us in whatever circumstances, whatever time it is. So it's called akaliko, timeless. Not bound by a place. The Dhamma is not only in the meditation hall, not in the text, just in the text. Not just to be found on the mountaintop, but sanditiko akaliko, whatever time, whatever circumstance, the way things are, the way of things is manifesting itself to us. Last night, we listened as Tanisara shared with us the fundamentally significant teachings of the Buddha called the Four Noble Truths. Just remembering this image of the hand full of leaves compared to all the knowledge the Buddha had. He said, like all the leaves in the forest, just picking up from the floor of the forest a handful, and said, but this is what I choose to emphasize. Yes, there's all this knowledge, but this is the knowledge that frees us from suffering. Not that there's no other knowledge, but sometimes we can be involved in all sorts of knowledge. We know that. We can be, many of us here are quite accomplished in various knowledges, various skills, which are very important in manifesting in the world. But even being a nuclear physicist and understanding the power that can create a nuclear plant, from electricity to homes, or the power of a bomb, even a nuclear physicist isn't necessarily free from suffering. So it's a certain kind of knowledge. The Buddha went on to say, it is through not understanding, not realizing these four things that I, disciples as well as you, had to wander so long through this round of rebirth. What are these four? The truth of dukkha. This origin, this fading, the cessation of suffering, and that path that leads to this cessation of suffering. Probably heard these Four Noble Truths tens of thousands of times. For a long time I could be suffering, the cause, the end, the path. When you live in monasteries, you hear lots of Dhamma talks. And sometimes when you're used to knowing something, yes, I know the Four Noble Truths. suffering calls ending past. Dukkha, Samudaya, Nirodha, Magga. Been here for 10 years. Now let's get some the next day. I thought this was an advanced retreat. Going back to the Four Noble Truths, you get that in the Sunday school classes of the other religions. But to little by little start to, yes, you get some points for remembering the Four Truths. But in and of themselves, it can become something else just to cling to. And as we really go deeply into these truths, the origin of the suffering is the clinging. And when knowledge is clung to, it's my knowledge, and we hold on to that, it causes contention, causes problems. So it's one thing to theoretically to memorize them, to theoretically understand. That's a start. That's important, I guess, theoretically understand. But then to move from theoretical understanding to actually bringing that understanding into our moment-to-moment contact with the suchness of our experience. So these noble truths, have they been infused, irrigated into what is happening when we're seeing a beautiful sight? Someone stands in our way. What's happening when we're hearing some beautiful sound and we get disturbed? When we're experiencing a beautiful mood and an angry person comes and spoils it. When we're Do these become reflectors, mirrors? These truths are useful and take us from suffering to the ending of suffering. When they're like a mirror, they help us see ourselves. They help us look into vipassana, look into, see into, inquire into the moments of our experience. And so now over the years, I now more and more appreciate hearing them again and again. Just as an encouragement then to come back. To something that's immediate. Is there anything stressful in this moment? There is dukkha. And the Buddha gave a definition of it, his first definition, so that everybody can relate. There's a pathway for everybody. Birth is dukkha, aging, sickness, death, sorrow, irritation, sadness. Being separated from what is dear to us. Can we relate to that? Experience of being separate from what we love. Being united with what we don't want to be united with. Being united with the unloved. Most of us, when we're united with a headache, it's not something to celebrate. Occasionally, there might be somebody who has a belief system that when they have a headache, they're burning off bad karma, so maybe you get excited about the headache. But for most of us, when we're united with the painful, united with someone that irritates us, united with a bad memory, united with a stomachache, united with exhaustion, separated from the love, united with the unloved, not getting what we want, this is not an esoteric experience. This is immediate for us. I would assume everybody. Does that ever happen to us, that we don't get what we want? Even having had a good meditation yesterday and then looking forward to that today, maybe even a little deeper, and something doesn't happen. It's too hot, it's too cold, the mind won't calm down. And then he said, in short, we recited this at the end of this recitation, during this recitation of the teachings this morning, in short, the focus is of the grasping mind. This is a clue that dukkha is a focus of a mind that's trying to grasp. So in this whole range of experience, there's something that we can relate to, that the Buddha is encouraging us to enter as a gateway. He didn't start with the third noble truth. He didn't start with Nibbana. He didn't say Nibbana. Say it loud. And again, in stereo, you know, because that would be theoretical. We don't know it. I believe in Nibbana. Yes, there's some trust. There's a trust that there's something that's peaceful. There's some possibility of freedom. There's something to understand. If we didn't have some basic trust, we wouldn't have the energy or the motivation to even come on retreat. There's some trust, but there's also the recognition we don't know. That trust is helpful without some idea that enlightenment's possible, without some sense that we're not just only trapped. If we believe, deeply believe, there's nothing we can do about our condition, that we're just stuck with it. Tough luck, buddy. Maybe next time. You know, then that leads to a fatalistic situation where there's just nothing you can do. You might as well just either get it while you can, go out there and have a good time, elbow the next person out of the way. Not much one can do. But if there's some sense, and I think that every people that are here, we're here because there's some sense is that there is a possibility of understanding our aversion, understanding our confusion, growing beyond our petty-mindedness. We all share some sense of the transformation process, some trust in it. I consider it very important, actually, having that. But then rather than making an article of faith to believe in Nibbana, to believe, to hold to that idea, the Buddha didn't teach that way, because that's asking us to do what, to pretend we know what we don't know. We don't know. Well, maybe someone knows, but they're already happy. They're peaceful. So they're fine. They can emanate that peaceful. That's why the first discourse that Tanisha shared when the Buddha made the lions roar, I am an all-transcender, who could be my teacher? The guy was left with the idea of just believing it. Or he didn't know what to do. He could just believe it, but he didn't know. So in rethinking, he offered a gateway, an entry point that is that we can access our stresses, our strains, being united with the unloved, being separated from the love. This is not hidden from us. Focus is being able to investigate the focuses of the grasping mind. This is something that's possible. And the magic of this is that if Nibbana is the top of the tree, it's not asking people to, like a kangaroo, leap to the top of the tree. It's encouraging us to work with what presents itself to us. And the magic is the more we work with the stressful, the more we work with the conditions, the more we work with what's manifesting, the mortal, the changing. The irony is the more we squarely face these moments, penetrating it with our investigation and understanding, we start to notice something else. Notice the context. Notice the space that everything's dissolving back into. This first noble truth, the Buddha said, needs to be understood. The worldly response to dukkha, as Tomisawa said last night, to recap, the worldly response is to immediately react when it's suffering. And to find someone to blame. Notice that breaks the immediate link with being with it. When we're blaming, we miss the pain. Quite effective for cutting off from the pain. And then energizing ourselves with the righteousness. Who did that? Energizing ourselves, you know. So suddenly we've kicked it upstairs to the head, not in touch so much with that pain. And going like that. So it just becomes something that shouldn't be here, that's your fault. We've created that as a reality. One possibility. Or immediately when we see it, you know, something's wrong, look for a way to obliterate it. Numb out. Avoid. Or turning it back in. Seeing this and woe is me. Look what's happened to me. This is a very interesting phenomenon that, you know, there is some experience of dukkha, some disease, and the tendency to avoid it. The Buddha has a very, very important simile about our relationship to pleasure and pain, which some of you, I'm sure, already have heard, but it's something we can contemplate today as we reflect on these ennobling truths. Instead of noble truth, the idea that we kind of grasp it and then have it and put it in our pocket, these truths, rather than absolutes to be grasped, are exhortations. They're encouragements to practice. Suffering needs to be understood, turned to, open to. So it's an ennobling truth. It's an activity, a contemplation, rather than something you got and put it in your pocket. I've got the noble truth. What do you got? It's ennobling, makes us more noble, more capacity, more able to meet life. Because the truth is an encouragement to, when there's dukkha, to be interested rather than blaming, rather than rejecting, to be interested. To understand it, to be with it, for the sake of understanding, not for the sake of racking up points. Aren't I a sufferer? Aren't I an amazing sufferer? You're suffering. You're looking at real suffering over here. It's not for puffing up the sense of who we are, but for the sake of understanding. And then as we do that, we start to see how, wait a minute, gee, this hasn't been inflicted. There's something that we're doing. all the noble truths aren't actually separate. They all start to flow into one another. The more we open to dukkha, the more we open to the experience of pain, the experience of aversion, the experience of struggle, we can start to notice how it's perpetuated by this grasping. And that's another exhortation, the second ennobling truth. It's an exhortation when we notice a mind that's tenaciously grasping or rejecting. Can we learn to let that go? Can we soften around that? Can we let that be? Normally when the mind wants, it's me wanting it. Me wanting to get rid of it. It's to let something be means we start to get the idea of letting a desire mind welling up. I've got to get out of here. Choking. Got to get out of here. That's first class desire. That's real. We've seen it, we've recognized it, but normally when that's just me, when there's not the ennobling truth, then we act on it. We don't reflect on it. There's not the exhortation to investigate that. Can we let it be and let it well up? I've got to get out of here. We start to notice, rather than me so much, we notice it as there is desire. There is aversion. Wow, look at the power of that. Look at the seduction of that. Look at the scariness of that. Because it feels like we're dying. I'm not joking. I'm dying. Welling up. Looks like. Notice, then we start to see it as a Dhamma rather than self so much. That's ennobling, because we have to access new resources, new parts of ourselves. When it's there, we just react to it. I won't. I don't want. So when I want, in our meditative process, if we're able to not just believe it, but to let it be, let it go, let it come and go, then we start to access a part of our being that's witnessing, that's watching, that's aware, that's not bound to that. This activity ennobles us because we start to access resources of ourselves that are patient, resources that are knowing, resources that are not grasping. To be able to be a moment with grasping and rejecting means we have to know a part of ourselves that's not grasping. Part of ourselves that's deeper than that. The third truth of tasting peace is to be realized. That's another exhortation. So these truths are exhortations in different circumstances to do something. They're living truths. They're active truths. They're not your classical thing to just hold. They directly translate into practice. That's why they call ennobling. The third truth to be realized. The fourth truth, the path, the awareness to be cultivated. Cultivating awareness when we speak, when we act, when we walk, when we think, when we feel like a failure in the world, when we feel like top of the world. Being aware. The Buddha said, the unlearned, unenlightened being experiences pleasant feelings and unpleasant feelings and neutral feelings. So the unenlightened being experiences all these feelings. The noble enlightened disciple also experiences pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, and neutral feeling. What is the distinction? What's the difference between the learned, noble disciple and someone who's unlearned, untrained, unenlightened? when an unlearned, unenlightened being encounters unpleasant fears, they grieve and lament and wail, beat our chest, distraught, distracted. Then that person experiences two kinds of feelings, in the body and in the mind. It's as if an archer fired one arrow into a certain person, and then to fire a second arrow. You give me an arrow, like a bow and arrow? Firing an arrow. It's as if an archer fired one arrow and then a second arrow. That person would experience pain from both arrows. Such is the unlearned, unenlightened being. They experience two kinds of pain, pain in the body and pain in the mind, in the heart, in the aware. Moreover, in experiencing this unpleasant feeling, the unenlightened person just feels displeased with it. I don't like it. It's someone who's not working with the noble truth. Don't like it. Displeased over that unpleasant or painful feeling, then tendencies toward aversion dependent on that feeling are accumulated. We start to build up habits of aversion. And confronted with this unpleasant, painful feeling, we seek delight and sense pleasure. So when we're untrained, when the pain comes, we go somewhere else, seeking delight in that something that's pleasing. Why? Why do we do that? Because the unlearned, unenlightened being doesn't know any other way of escape from painful feelings than just to seek distraction. We're facing something unpleasant, notice the tendency to just go somewhere else. It's a memory, present memory, the present thought of the future. Notice how often if you have a painful knee or something. Thinking of the ending of sitting, of walking, present memory. Interesting. Okay, so we distract. Sometimes we can distract ourselves, delighting thus in sense pleasure, then a latent tendency toward greed or lust starts to build up. This person then doesn't know the origin or the cessation or the attraction or the limitation and release from feelings as they are. Not knowing things as they really are, then tendencies toward delusion accumulate in relationship to neutral feelings. So experiencing pleasure or pain or neutral feeling, that person is bound. Bound to birth, age, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. Bound to suffering. Now what about the learned or the enlightened disciple? The enlightened disciple experiences a painful feeling too. Someone asked him one of their questions. Awakened beings experience pain. The Buddha had piercing pain when he was sick. When his first cousin tried to kill him and pushed the boulder down a mountain, luckily it split before the full thing hit the Buddha, but a part of it broke the Buddha's foot, part of his foot. Very painful. His toe. Certainly had, but he didn't have aversion to it, but there still was pain. So the awakened disciple experiences unpleasant feelings, but he doesn't grieve or lament or wail about it. He's not distressed about it. He experiences pain, the awakened being experiences pain only in the body, not in the heart, not in the mind. Just as if an archer, having shot one arrow into a certain man, were then to shoot a second arrow, but the second arrow misses. In this case, that person would experience pain only on account of the first arrow, the physical pain. Such is the learned awakened disciple. He experiences pain in the body, but not in the citta, in the heart, in the mind. Not creating extra pain, by not wanting it to be there. This being doesn't experience displeasure on account of that pain. Not being displeased, then there aren't tendencies toward aversion building up. Experiencing that feeling, then, this being does not seek distraction away from it. Why not? Because a noble disciple knows of a way out of unpleasant feeling other than just through distraction. What are the ways out? Well, sometimes the situation is the way out is one has to just be patient. Some pains are the way they are because of being born. Old age, sickness, and death is a condition. But sometimes through attention to pain, you start to notice how to alleviate. You might notice you have a pain. If you don't like it and just distract yourself, you feel a pain in the foot, just override it. Do something else. Think of where you're going. You might investigate and notice there's a thorn in your foot. You pull it out. Pain is actually helpful. Sometimes we notice, there's a cut, and then we try to tend to it. Pain calls awareness, and when awareness, someone's also asking a question about pain, awareness tends to help things come into balance. So some pains can be alleviated. But all pains are changing. But that's working with pain rather than trying to solve pain through just changing our attention, going somewhere else. Because the awakened disciple doesn't distract away from pain, just into sense pleasure, then tendencies toward greed are not accumulated. That being knows the origin and cessation and limitation and release from feelings as they are. Tendencies toward delusion are not accumulated. Therefore, the awakened being is not bound to feeling, not bound to birth and death. In our contemplation today, in our meditation. Be able to ask a question, is there dukkha? Is there pain? Is there stress? And some kind of pain, what's called dukkha, is just painful. And you notice the extra pain that can come. If you notice not wanting something to be here. The extra pain of aversion. The second error. It doesn't want this sensation. It doesn't want this thought. It doesn't want this feeling. And notice whether we can let that be. Notice in a moment whether there's, if there happens to be pain, whether there's just pain. And if there's no aversion and no grasping, there still might be pain. But it's just the pain of the body. Can we be at peace with that pain? You are experiencing pleasure. Pleasant state, pleasant sight from the walk, notice the pleasant sight. feeling of ease. Can we also notice the dukkha of pleasure? Not to imply that it's not pleasant. Pleasure is pleasant. But just noticing that when we hold on to that, we can then be anxious of losing it. And we notice that the nature of pleasure is to cheer. Even when we're looking at a beautiful flower, it's beautiful. It's uplifting. It's got an ultimately satisfying experience forever and ever. How long can one look at it? And we shift, the eyes blink. Gaze 5 minutes. 1 minute. I might get tired. Not to say things aren't beautiful. This first ennobling truth, the focuses of the grasping mind, is not saying that there isn't pleasure. But it's saying that it is dukkha when we grasp at it, because it's shifting. So the secret to understanding dukkha to start looking at the tendency, the nature of things to shift and change. This characteristic of change. Because every moment is changing. Every moment of hearing is changing. Every sound is changing. Every sight is changing. Just notice, even when we look, something beautiful, how the light shifts. The eyes are shifting, the attention shifts. The body shifts. The wind and elements are shifting. Temperature is shifting. If that really is the case, and as we look and experience and open ourselves, contact to the moment, start to notice that, then where could anything be stable? What thing? That's why the focus is of the grasping mind. If we grasp at something that's changing, it's bound to be to let us down. So it's not saying everything's bad. It's saying when we grasp at something, it will let us down. Or the original word of the Buddha is if we climb up on top of something that then collapses, we fall. We grasp at our pleasant meditation and stand on it, that's mine, then when it shifts and changes, I've lost it. We grasp our insight and our confidence, yes, I see it now, I finally got it. We stand on top of that, oh God, it took long enough. Four retreats, I guess I should announce it. It was hard, believe me. You've got it. We stood there. We feel what it's like to be. They might just start calling me Tovanov. Mr. Tovanov. Mrs. Tovanov. Mr. and Mrs. Tovanov. And then something happens. And I told everybody. I better go on a 5-year silent retreat. They won't know. The sense of having lost. We may climb up onto a mood. Climb onto something. Literally, what does it mean, climb on? It means, the Buddha called it becoming. That's what this grasping means. It's mine. Yeah. Whew. Then, if you're sitting on something and this thing was a collapse, believe me, you'd see a surprise on my face. Not only is it clear, but guess what? Even the very earth that we're on is unstable. Look in Indonesia and Thailand and Sri Lanka. I mean, you know, people in this country know that too, with the stresses and strains of living here. Africa, big time too. You don't know. It's good to remember that yes, we touch and are in contact with things, but if we demand them to be stable, which our delusion somehow thinks when we attach to a view or an opinion or a state of health, when we do that, that's birth. And then the condition changes, that's there. And samsara is scanning to find new stability. As we start to contact this stress, this strain, and start to notice that things are changing, then we understand dukkha. Of course it's suffering to grasp it. So when we say, oh, it's dukkha, it's not a bad label, it's dukkha to grasp it, we can still appreciate it. This is a poem that some people think it's trite. I think it's quite profound. It's Blake's poem on eternity. You know that? He who binds to himself a joy, my, does the winged life destroy. Winged, it's a fleeting thing with wings. He who binds to himself a joy, does the winged life destroy. He who kisses the joy as it flies, lives in eternity, sunrise. It's not that there's no contact. We're still in contact. And remember last night, Tanisha said, if we're in contact with the world in a certain way, it's wonderful existence. If we're in contact with the world in another way, it becomes this dukkha. So people misunderstand thinking that this is just calling it all dukkha. Yes, there is dukkha. Dukkha arises to the grasp. And yes, because, but what about the pain in my knee? When's that going to go away? People used to ask our teacher, why is this happening to me? And our teacher would say, because you're born. When you get born and have a sensitive body, there's going to be pain. And yes, we should look after them and do the best we can. But there's some things. I mean, I've worked with so many different pains. But, you know, you sort of think certain things you don't expect to go wrong on you. I've been so lucky with my legs, I suppose, for all these years. I've been, you know, sitting. I had pains and stuff. I've worked through it. And, you know, but 30 years down the road, this knee suddenly rebelling on me. And I'm thinking, what is going on there? Twisting it, I just cut through it, and that's called the second arrow. And then, you know, in our moments of letting go of that, then it is just what it is. And kitty soul, you are 53. You are aging. You know, it's going on. And it's, why? Because you're born. Because it is that way. So today, let's really contemplate. Contemplate that everything is changing. Stay with the steadiness of heart. We can't really be in contact with a moment without some samadhi. Because it's not a theoretical thing. We have these insights by being with a moment. Being with a moment. That takes the samadhi aspects like vitakka. It's something that steadies us somewhere. Vichara explores. Samatha and vipassana work that way. Some steadiness of mind brings us to a moment. Insight notices the change, or the stress, or the grasping of the aversion. Don't be afraid to stabilize ourselves in sitting and walking and breathing. And then occasionally just notice, is it changing? Can we see the dukkha of when things are changing, that there's nothing that can be grasped? If you go on a walk, even if you know a beautiful flower, can you appreciate the beauty, but can you notice that it's dukkha in the sense that it goes by? It will. It shifts. It's not denying the beauty, but it's honoring it for what its nature is.